going to go ahead and introduce our speaker today. And just to remind you again to please put us on mute. And if you don't have a mute button, again, it's star six. And please do not put us on hold for fear of music in the background. Okay, so today you'll be hearing from Jane Baer, who is a chemical engineer and has been with EPA for 24 years. She's with our Office of Research and Development. She is one of 14 recognized international experts on the United Nations Environment Program, UNEP, Society of Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry International Life Cycle Panel, which is the governing body of the UNEP SeaTac Life Cycle Initiative. She has served on the U.S. Green Building Council's Life Cycle Assessment, Integration into Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, also known as LEED, their working group, as well as DuPont's Bio-Based Advisory Group, the American Institute of Chemical Engineer Sustainability Metrics Working Group, the National Institute of Science and Technology, NIST's Bio-Based Advisory Group, and numerous SeaTac North American and SeaTac Europe Life Cycle Impact Assessment Working Groups. She has organized and chaired three international special topic workshops on LCIA, Life Cycle Impact Assessment, and was active in the ISO 14042 Life Cycle Impact Assessment Development. She is the developer of US EPA's Tool for Reduction and Assessment of Chemical and Other Impacts, also known as TRACE, which has been widely distributed and used. TRACE has been selected and used by the U.S. Green Building Council, the National Institute of Standards and Technologies, BEES, or Buildings for Environmental and Economic Sustainability, as well as the U.S. Marine Corps ECAT, pre-consultants SimaPro LCA software, PE Engineers Gabby LCA software, NSF International, and American National Standards NSF 140 2005 Sustainable Carpets Assessment Draft Standard. Her TRACE research was recognized in April 2006 with an individual gold medal for exceptional service, the highest EPA honor award. So please welcome Ms. Jane Baer today, and she will go ahead and get started with her presentation on understanding life cycle assessment and life cycle impact assessment applications for Osworth Land and Materials Management. And Jane, take it over.
Thank you, Penny. I tend to talk fast, so Penny, feel free to interrupt me if I start getting faster and faster as the presentation goes on. And I will be available for questions at the end, so feel free to make notes or send them to Penny, and we'll discuss them when we're done. I'm going to try to cover a lot of bases today. I'm on slide one, the format. What is LCA? What steps are included in conducting one? What do we need to know about life cycle impact assessment? Why use TRACE? And what do we need to know about weighting? And how would this look for a green remediation site? The last example there, I am using an example from Karen Sherman from Region 9, and she should be on the line. So if you have any specific questions about the remediation site, hopefully Karen will help me with those. So slide two, what is an LCA? Typically, it's an evaluation of a product or service on a functional unit basis over the full life cycle. So you would include all about the raw materials, the transportation, the manufacturing, including the suppliers if there's several different steps in the manufacture, the use phase, and the recycle or disposal phase. Now you might want to note the term functional unit. That might be new to you. A functional unit is typically whatever common function that product or service is filling. For example, if you were comparing automobiles, you might want to say, my functional unit is transporting two passengers, each 150 pounds over 100,000 miles, for example. That might be how you define your functional unit. Or you might say that I am going to have a suitable floor space covering for 100 square feet. That would be a functional unit. If you were comparing grocery bags, you might say I want to carry 5 pounds of groceries over 500 feet without having it break. So somehow you define what it is that you want to compare that is going to be consistent with everything that you're comparing as options. For a remediation site, it looks a little bit different. I'm going to flip to slide 3. For a remediation site, you might look at a specific level of cleanup over the full life cycle, including the same steps that I mentioned above for all the goods and services which are used in the cleanup phase. Now, at this point, I want to step back and say, I recognize that LCA is not the only piece of information that people use in decision making. There's a short bullet list here. Other factors that might be included would be like the cleanup schedule. If one of the options is available much sooner than the other, then that might be a reason why that option would be selected. Cost of remediation, maybe even the public perception or any other influencing factors. So an LCA is typically one factor that is included in decision making, not necessarily the only factor that is included. Slide 4, I'm going to give you just a quick glance at the remediation site example that I'm going to be doing at the end. So here you don't need to understand all the details, but you simply notice that this is an example developed by Karen Sherman. It has the emissions and resources for each activity included in the analysis. And she uses the terminology of levels 1, 2, and 3, whereas in LCA they would typically have different life cycle stages. But I'll explain it the way that Karen has conducted it. It's probably a bit more familiar with those of you working in remediation. So I'm looking at level 5 now. I'm going to jump back into what is LCA. And within an LCA, you can see the framework that is pictured here, adapted from ISO 14040 series. You have the goal and scope, the inventory analysis, the impact assessment, and the interpretation are the major phases. The life cycle impact assessment phase is the one that I have concentrated on the most for the last approximately 14 years, and which I continue to work on in the UNEP CTEC life cycle initiative. The inventory analysis phase is very important and significant phase, and often takes a good bit of the time that is conducted for an LCA, because basically you not only need to know the emissions and the resources used at your location, but also the transport to your location and every one of your suppliers and manufacturers prior to that point. At this point, I'd also like to point out the arrows that are going between the boxes. And if you look at this, an LCA can be an iterative process. If you have conducted a life cycle impact assessment, you have some idea for where your major impacts are happening. You may do some sort of improvement analysis, change your alternative a little bit, and then go through it again to see how it compares to the other two options after you've finished that. On slide 6, I want to introduce Tracy. Tracy is the tool for the reduction assessment of chemical and other environmental impacts. It allows the characterization of impacts for life cycle assessment, sustainability metrics, process design, facility level analysis, or company level analysis. And I'll show you in a little bit how it is so versatile. It was developed for the U.S. with site-specific characterization for several of the impact categories. And then at the bottom, I make a note here, the users do need to provide emissions data or resource use data to develop an impact assessment. That third bullet is also the reason why, when you heard the introduction, Penny mentioned that Tracy is included in several other pieces of software. Because when people do a life cycle assessment, a lot of times they'll say, this is great, now I see how to do an impact assessment, but the inventory phase is so difficult, I need a separate tool to bring me all of the inventory that I don't have. So that's when people would use things like Bees and Simipro and Gabi and all of the other tools that were mentioned there. So if I go on to slide 7, I'm going to give you your first diagram view of Tracy. And the important thing I want to point out now is the second box from the left and the top. I already mentioned the inventory of stressors is something that you need to know. Either if you're going to do it on a facility basis or a company basis, or if you're going to do it on a life cycle assessment basis, you might need some help from other software that's available. But if you look at the second box from the left, those are the impact categories that Tracy does the characterization for. So So categories like ozone depletion and global warming, acidification, eutrophication, smog, and so on. The top right block, which shows characterization, is simply a cartoon drawing which shows that for each of those impact categories, we've included the most sophisticated impact assessment methodology. So it may be entirely different how we do fate and transport for eutrophication, for example, than how we would do it for human health cancer. And there are various reasons for that. But my block there just was a sort of a placeholder to tell you there's a lot of underlying details in the impact assessment methodologies. I'm not going to go into every single impact category today. I'm going to give you probably a couple of impact categories. We'll go through those, and I'll talk about how those were developed. And then the bottom right, I want to point out the eutrophication, global warming, ozone depletion. Those are like separate file folders. So when you're finished with Tracy, you can have graphs like that. If you're comparing alternative A, B, and C, there's your three bars on the bar graph for eutrophication. You might see that B looks better than A or C just by a little bit. But what I do not do is I don't combine eutrophication, global warming, and ozone depletion all into a single score. I keep each of those file folders, so to speak, separately, keep each of the impact categories separately, because it's when you go beyond those impact categories and try to combine scores, that's when you go beyond the science, in many cases include the value choices and additional assumptions that don't necessarily line up with the science. So I'm going to go into slide 8, which is a little bit more of a description here. On the previous slide, I pointed out that Tracy stops at the point where the impact category is available independently. Now, some people do like to aggregate that into 1, 3, or some number of environmental scores, and they don't necessarily want to keep it as impact categories. What you'll see here is how this could be done for the impact category of ozone depletion. The midpoint level, which is the largest rectangular box, is where Tracy stops. This is where there's international consensus on how to calculate the ozone depletion potentials, and the science is really strong leading up to the midpoint level. If one were to try to calculate all the possible endpoints and then sum them up into damage indicators, like disability-adjusted life years or dollars, as you see in the bottom left-hand part of the screen, you would find that it's currently impossible to perform the calculations totally based on science. The other thing that you might notice is that only the blue was able to be calculated and therefore included into the damage indicator. All of the endpoints that are white, that is crop impacts, impacts on plants and cataracts and other things like that, if there is no science that could be utilized to calculate, quantify those impacts, they simply drop off, which is the bottom right-hand part of the screen there. So the important point that this slide makes is that when you're using an impact assessment model, it's often very complicated to know how did they do their calculations, what's included, what fell out, what's the uncertainties in all of that. And many times you might have to read 300 pages worth of documentation to find out what's in an impact assessment methodology. And I could go through several of the impact assessment methodologies that are out there. But at this point in time, I'm going to concentrate on Tracy and tell you why it is that the US EPA developed Tracy to be the way that it is. And again, on this slide 8, the main point of this slide is to show you that Tracy operates at the midpoint level, which is the largest rectangular block, and that is because that's where the strong science international consensus exists. And when you go below that point, you're going to be using a lot more assumptions and a lot more value choices. And
hey, Jane, this is Penny. I just want to let you know it's actually slide 9 that we're on, the best decision points, and we'll be moving on to slide 10.
Oh, I must be off by one then. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay.
Okay. So I'm going to have to try to remember that I'm always behind by one slide. So the next slide is slide 10, and on this one, I want to spend a couple minutes. Remember I said that each of the impact categories have their own impact assessment methodology underneath them. I'm not going to go through all of them, but I am going to talk about cancer, non-cancer, and ecotoxicity. And the reason I lump all three of these together is because the fate and transport for these are typically the same. It's when you get to the potency or the toxicity when things change. So if you go to the next slide, which is 11, originally TRACY was developed with Caltox as the basis for human health cancer, non-cancer, and ecotoxicity. And the reason for that was that Caltox was recognized by the US EPA Science Advisory Board as the most sophisticated risk assessment model. It is consistent with EPA's risk assessment guidelines and the Human Exposure Factor Handbook. It provided 23 human exposure pathways, and very importantly, it had a crystal ball link, which would allow us to do parameter uncertainty and variability analysis. And I'll show you in a minute why that's important. If you go to slide 12, you'll see what we did was we looked at the various uncertainties and variabilities involved in the input parameters. So if you look at uncertainties coming from places like chemical property data and variabilities that might be found in population, in meteorology, maybe the surrounding environment. So if you go to slide 13 now, you'll see bar graphs, horizontal bar graphs, and it says parameter uncertainty and variability analysis. What you see there, if you notice, the red bars dominate for uncertainty and variability. This analysis was done for TRACY using Caltox, and we tried to cover as many of the TRI substances as we could cover. And what we found was the red bar, which is the chemical physical properties, were the ones that dominated whenever you did uncertainty variability analysis. So this included things like half-lives and toxicities. How well do you know the half-life? How well do you know the toxicity? You can see that the blue bar, which is landscape, things like soil type and meteorology, were not that important. And things like the things in the white bar, which included body weight, age, perhaps differences in diet, like whether primarily meat-eating, vegetarian, or high fish consumptive population, those things did not typically matter for the majority of the TRI substances. There may have been one or two where those were important, but for the vast majority of TRI chemicals, it was the red bar that really dominated the analysis. Now, one of the reasons that this is important is because this supported for us the theory that you could come up with a human toxicity potential for cancer, non-cancer, that could be representative of the whole United States. And this has been extrapolated to globally. Globally, you could come up with a human toxicity potential if you're trying to cover a large number of chemicals that could be used for anywhere in the world, no matter what your diet patterns were and differences in population and meteorology and soil types. I'm going on to slide 14 now, and this is the UNEP-CTAC International Life Cycle Panel. At the beginning, Penny mentioned that I am on this panel. I'm also operating within the working groups on life cycle impact assessment. The acronyms there, life cycle management is the M, life cycle inventory, and then the life cycle impact assessment program. Within the life cycle impact assessment program, we found that a lot of people worldwide were confused prior to the year 2000 because there were different models available in the life cycle assessment community about how to do human health cancer, non-cancer. And there was not an understanding about why that should be different in different places in the world. And if you look at it, there were a number of factors that were at play here. One of them was every country had their own list. You know, we have the TRI list, for example. Europe had a different list, and, you know, Japan had another list, and Australia had another list. So everybody's working off their own set of chemicals, and then everyone has their own type of risk assessment guidelines and exposure factor handbooks, and so there were things coming, trying to do the same sort of thing, but they were coming at different angles. So the UNEP-CTEC Life Cycle Panel had asked the people who were in the Life Cycle Impact Assessment Program if they could come up with a consensus model. If all of the modelers from around the world could come together over a series of workshops and over a series of years and come up with one model which would be representative and probably better than all that were currently out there. Now, the model that I'm talking about is called USE-TOX, but at this point in time, it's not currently available. You'll see I have two papers which are attached, and one of the papers, both of the papers are more about the development of USTalks. There is a draft spreadsheet, which is online at usetalks.org, but at this point in time, they don't have a full set of data in there. There are some key chemicals that are missing, including the metals. So at this point in time, it's still a work in progress. At some point in the future, when it is at a more developed stage, we hope to put this through the US EPA peer review process and see if it does pass peer review or if modifications can be made so that it will pass peer review. It may be included in future versions of TRACE. I just skipped on to slide 15 now, much of which I've already covered. The only thing I wanted to point out here, Tom McCone and Edgar Hirschwich were both crucial in TRACE development of the impact categories. Tom McCone, who is at UC Berkeley, is also involved in the USTalks analysis. But as I said again, there are a couple of papers that are included there if you're really interested in things like where did the data come from, what does the model look like, even digging into the spreadsheet. I encourage you to go to the website. Slide 16 now should list two of the papers that I mentioned earlier, as well as the website. Now on slide 17, Penny, can you confirm that I'm still on the right slide for you?
Yep, you're on the right slide.
Okay, great, thanks. Okay, I'm transitioning to a slightly different topic. I'm still within life cycle impact assessment. If you notice that now within TRACE, I'm pointing to land use and water use, which are the two impact categories that are grayed out. And the reason they grayed out is because they don't currently exist within TRACE. All of the other categories do exist. In some ways, we kind of picked the low-hanging fruit, the easy ones at the beginning. Easy because there were already regulations which told us which chemicals were important and how we value those impact categories, what the potencies were. So those were easy because we could build on the sophisticated models that we already had within the agency. Land use and water use are entirely different. In many ways, they've been the most difficult categories to work on since they're not really related to any existing environmental regulations. With increasing food production and biofuels production, these categories are likely to become even more and more important in the future. For those of you who are within the agency, if you know what a GIPR deliverable is, I have a GIPR deliverable next week, which is a draft paper available for submission, which talks about recommendations for land use impact assessment for biofuels. I have a similar GIPR deliverable on water use impact assessment for biofuels this time next year. So at this point, I'm going to guess maybe 6 months into the future, if you contact me again, I can get you a copy of that paper in print, and you can see what direction we're headed in those two, in at least the land use category. If you wait another year, you'll get a direction for the recommendations on water use. If you go to the next slide, 18, now just a transition slide here for TRACE status. A lot of this Penny already mentioned. The U.S. Green Building Council LEED, a lot of people don't realize that the new version uses TRACE, so I'm going to go into that a little bit later. NIST uses TRACE within BEES, and I'm going to cover that as well. The other ones I just mentioned here in passing. And then slide 19 gives you the TRACE references, a couple of papers, a couple of websites. And there are more papers. If you go into the website, there are more papers related to life cycle impact assessment, kind of a chronology of my thoughts and research all the way back from 1995 to today. So if you're really interested, there's a lot of reading material on the website. Okay, so now I'm on slide 20. And you'll see the arrow is now pointing back to the separate file folders of eutrophication, global warming, and ozone depletion. The question often comes up in TRACE, how do you deal with trade-offs? What if option A looks better for global warming, but option B looks better for ozone depletion and eutrophication? What do you do then? Well, I mentioned earlier that TRACE stops at presenting these as separate graphs. We don't sum them up to a single score. However, we do know that many people use TRACE and do want to sum up to a single score. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how that's being done. If you look at slide 21, you'll see BEES 4.0. And you also see the BEES website is listed there if you're interested in more information here. BEES stands for Building for Environmental and Economic Sustainability, and it's put out by NIST. It uses TRACY for the impact assessment, and then it applies normalization and weighting to combine things to come up with an overall environmental performance score. And then it combines that with an economic performance score for an overall score. Now, BEES has a number of different scoring approaches, which they have available within BEES that you can choose. I'm going to talk about one in specific that was just developed. The most recent one was developed in May of 2006. So if you go to slide 22, the NIST Weighting Workshop happened in May of 2006, and I was there that day not as a presenter, but as a voting stakeholder. So there were LCA experts, users, and producers, and those probably about 19 stakeholders started the day by saying, you know, I may be a representative from Company X or US EPA, but I have my own individual biases and perspectives. I am obviously biased by the media that I listen to and my previous experiences all the way back to my childhood. So what I'm about to say today does not reflect the agency, you know, does not reflect the company. This is pretty much how everyone began the day in May of 2006. Over the course of the day, we all had remote controls in which we could vote about the relative importance of these various impact categories. Now, I should mention, prior to the weighting, there was a normalization step which was conducted, and that normalization step was to put each of these categories on the basis of the U.S. annual emissions for that impact category in the year 2006. So if you looked at what is this particular product's relative contribution to global warming relative to smog formation? Maybe they were a much bigger player in smog formation than they were in global warming, for example. That is how the normalization was conducted. And then the weighting was simply how important or how significant do each of those stakeholders believe that that impact category is relative to the other. Now, you might notice here there is a significant difference in how people voted, whether they were LCA experts, users, or producers. And but the other thing that you might notice is that global warming was placed the highest by all three categories. The next thing you might notice is that fossil fuel depletion was second. And there was significant discussion about fossil fuel depletion. A lot of people said, you know, should we even include that as an impact category? Because fossil fuel depletion, you know, once we're finished with fossil fuels, we'll probably have an alternative that we can use for an energy source. So is this really an environmental impact, or is this just something that is an economic issue? The discussions then went into things like, well, do you think that any of the casualties of the Middle East wars have anything to do with fossil fuel depletion? So you can see the discussions really went all over the board that day. And they weren't so much discussions to tell people how to vote as they were discussions to kind of open people's eyes and say, you may or may not want to consider this when you're voting. So you can see this is the results of 19 stakeholders on that one day in May of 2006. If you did it again today, it may turn out differently. If you did it with a different group of people, it may turn out differently. But this particular weighting set is one of the only one I'm aware of that has been conducted like this in the United States, and it's one of the few that has been conducted globally with the level of rigor that they did on that particular day. I say level of rigor, but even that, a lot of people felt very uncomfortable with it, as if it's such a difficult task that you can't really make those decisions based on one day's discussion. I'm going to skip on to slide 23 now. And I just talked about NIST and BEES and weighting. And that is used along with TRACY in the U.S. Green Building Council's LEED 2009. And there should be a couple of PDFs that are attached. I mentioned those here. These are the the documents that describe how Tracy and this weighting is used in LEAD 2009. If you skip to the next slide, which is 24, you'll see that LEAD uses US EPA's Tracy because they represent a comprehensive, currently available complement to LEAD, which is appropriate for the North American building market. It is layered on top of the Tracy environmental impact categories with the weightings under the auspices of NIST. So you can see the direction that was used there. And there is a credit weighting software program that assigns the weights to the individual LEAD credits. So the weighting for 2009, I know the people who were in the U.S. Green Building Council did not want to make dramatic changes in one particular year. So you may see a series of years with a series of smaller changes as LEAD gradually goes more and more into LCA with LEAD. Within this particular version, 2009, you'll see that the current score sums up to 100 points for all the activity groups, and the certified silver, gold, and platinum are now 40, 50, 60, and 80% of the points. I'm going to go to slide 25. The 10-step process, I just cut and pasted this from the LEAD document there. Note that the LEAD building prototype is the first thing that's done. It's characterized with Tracy impact categories. And then you'll see in step 7 that the Tracy B's exercise weighting was used for the combined credit weighting. So that same workshop that I talked about in May of 2006 is used within the LEAD 2009. And then finally, the points are rounded to a whole number and then transferred back to the existing scorecard for each system. I'm going to move on now to slide 26, and this is where we get into the remediation. So the case study was almost entirely the effort of Karen Sherman in Region 9. When Karen first came to Cincinnati in February of 2000, I'm located in Cincinnati for all of those on the phone who wasn't aware, weren't aware of that. When she first came to Cincinnati in February of 2009, she already had a really great start. She had set up all the alternatives. She'd gathered a lot of the basic inventory data on site in the transport and with her suppliers. She had a couple of data gaps that she wanted to talk about. How can I fill in these inventory gaps? And she wanted to learn more about how to use the impact assessment within Tracy. So again, I want to point out Karen should be in the audience today. So at the end of the talk, if you have questions specific to this part of the presentation, I may be referring some of those to Karen. I'm on slide 27 now. And as you'll notice from this slide forward, almost every one of the slides at the top will say from Karen Sherman's presentation, either in February of 2009 when she came out to Cincinnati, or in some of the later slides, you'll see June of 2009 when she made a presentation. I forget where that presentation is, but I'm sure she can tell us at the end of the this talk. This slide shows the basic goal of her project. She wanted to estimate an environmental footprint, which is the terminology that she uses, at a corrective action cleanup site. In this case, it's the Romick site in East Palo Alto, California. So if you go to slide 28, you can see the actual location of this site. It's right there on the San Francisco Bay. It's a 14-acre hazardous waste management facility. There was soil and groundwater contaminants, VOCs, and contamination to the level of 80 feet. I'm on slide 29 now. She had a couple of different options that she was considering, and even some hybrid options. The two major different options were bioremediation and pump and treat. So if you look at the left side, you see the bioremediation alternative with injections of cheese whey and molasses mixed with water. On the right, you have the more traditional pump and treat alternative of treating groundwater and air strippers followed by carbon filters. I'm going to slide 30 now. There are four alternatives named. Only three were considered seriously because alternative one is do nothing, which wasn't even considered. Alternative two is a hybrid approach using bioinjection wells and extraction wells, and it was estimated this would take 30 years to complete. Alternative three was a bioremediation approach, and it was estimated to take 10 years to complete. And my understanding from Karen is that they had already done some testing to ensure that this really was a reliable estimate and maybe even a little bit pessimistic, that it may be even quicker than that, that the bioremediation action would work. Alternative 4 was a traditional pump and treat with extraction wells only, and was estimated to take about 40 years to complete. I also want to point out that being on the San Francisco Bay, I think time was a very important factor in this project. The decision was actually made prior to what you're about to see as the analysis here. And the decision was made to go with alternative 3, which is the bioremediation. And I think time was very important there to them. But you will see the results of the environmental analysis, or footprint, as Karen calls it, over the next several slides. So 31 is simply her listing of some of the majority of the resources and energy used, the waste generated, and the air emissions. 32, this is what Karen defines as level 1, on-site activities. So on the left, you have the well construction and bioinjections. On the right, you have the groundwater extraction and treatment. So the two strongest alternatives there. I say strongest, the two most different alternatives there. Level 2, Karen defined as being transport to and from the site. So this is operators coming to the site and waste going off-site, as well as materials coming to the site. Level 3 being off-site manufacture. Now, traditionally in an LCA, this could be broken up into several different phases, but for Karen, what this includes, when she says PVC pipe manufacture, it means everything up to the point of PVC pipe manufacturing, so all the way back to, which you wouldn't necessarily see in this diagram, but that is included within her life cycle assessment for level 3. Similarly, for the cheeseway, you have all the inputs needed to maintain the cow. And then your electricity production would go all the way back to the origins of the fossil fuel used for the energy production. Okay, slide number 35 now. This is the diagram of alternative 2, the most complex option, with bioremediation and pump and treat extraction wells. Karen determined that the inventory of every item that was needed on site, including the operators who needed to be transported to the site. So she asked her suppliers for the inventory data at their locations. And when she came in November, she had some guesses about the remote activities, which is pretty common for an LCA, but she wanted to know if she could have stronger data for those things that were happening in level 3, the raw materials manufacture of things that were used on site. Some of the results on slide 36. This is basic inventory results. So if you look at, you know, just basically how much PVC pipe is used by alternatives 2, 3, and 4, how much cement is used, you know, all of these different inventory items. So just simply looking at inventory, alternative 3 already looks better for most of the inventory items when you're considering on-site and transportation. So it looked better for all of them except cement, molasses, water, and I think cheeseway, which wasn't included in this graph of Karen's. I'm not quite sure why cheeseway isn't in here, but it should be for all of those. So the next step was really to analyze whether the summation of all the impacts for alternative 3 were really better. One of the things we wanted to look at was water, and this graph shows all the water used throughout the life cycle for the three alternatives. When we got to this point in our discussions in February, Karen and I had some pretty significant discussions about water. And you'll see that reflected in her slide number 38, which was her presentation in June. Basically, all water is not equal. Some of the water is withdrawn and returned, whereas some of the other water may have been consumed. Some of the water may have been consumed in an area that is water scarce, and some of it may have been consumed in an area that's water abundant. And then finally, what's the water quality at the points of consumption and discharge? So simply to add a gallon of water, no matter where it happens, is not necessarily a good recommendation for impact assessment. And Karen realized this after discussions in February. On slide 39 now, you'll see alternative 3 looks great for the electricity consumption. On slide 40, again, Alternative 3 looks great for CO2 emissions. And on slide 41, the point that Karen was making with this slide was to note how much of the CO2 emissions happened off-site. This is a pretty crucial slide. She actually had a series of slides making this point, but I only pulled this one out. And that was, if you only looked at what's happening on your site, you would miss so much of what is happening through the full life cycle assessment. And this was true with electricity consumption as well as CO2 emissions for this particular site. So I'm up to slide 42 now. Region 9's lessons learned. It is feasible, and I kind of pieced this together from discussions with Karen as well as several of the other slides that she had in her June talk. It is feasible to estimate the environmental footprint of a cleanup remedy. It's important to include the off-site manufacturing in estimates of the environmental footprint. You need to identify which materials and activities contribute the greatest to the impact category, for example, the CO2 footprint, and research them thoroughly. And you need to consider the balance of environmental assessment, the timing of the cleanup, and the cost. And finally, a streamlined methodology would be helpful for conducting this type of analysis at other sites. Slide 43, I have some references from earlier in the presentation, and that's pretty much the end of my talk. I want to open it up now first with Karen to give a chance to say anything that I may have misrepresented or anything that she'd like to pull out that I didn't necessarily mention today. So if Karen is on the line, if you can unmute your line and go ahead and talk to the audience, I'd be happy to hear if you have any comments.
Yeah. Hi, Jane. This is Karen Sherman. I don't have anything really substantive, but just to mention that the results that Jane showed there are what we consider preliminary results. We are actually in the process of improving and refining the study to be more complete in terms of the manufacturing data that's included, and also in terms of what sorts of aspects of the environmental footprint we're going to be quantifying. We're going to add in waste generation as well as particulate emissions and a few other things into what we consider the overall environmental footprint. So we're hopefully going to be improving upon it based on my discussions with Jane in February and based on a lot of comments that we've gotten on the preliminary results as we've been presenting them over the months. So basically, that's our plan, and we also are hoping that our experience in doing this kind of analysis will be what we intend for it to be used in a methodology that EPA is going to be developing. Our headquarters office will be developing a methodology for running this kind of analysis, which will hopefully be useful for others to follow in the event that they want to do a similar sort of analysis on other cleanup sites.
Thanks, Karen. Penny, I'm going to turn it over to you now.
Okay, well, thank you for that, Jane and Karen. Just wanted to open it up to folks on the line. If you have questions you'd like to ask, please go ahead and do so. I have while we're waiting for folks to chime in, I have a question here. Jane, on slide 22, you had some examples of groups that came together to produce the weighting, and that included groups of people that were LCA experts, users, and producers. Who has used this weighting from this particular group other than the U.S. Green Building Council lead 2009 weighting?
Yeah. Let me back up just a little bit, because the terminology users and producers does not refer to users of the NIST-BEES weighting tool so much, or not so much the weighting workshop, because they weren't fully aware of how much it would be used in the future. If you look at the title of the talk above, it's Life Cycle Impact Assessment Weights to Support Environmental Preferable Purchasing in the United States. So they were specifically looking at that as the producers and producers at that point in time, so it wasn't so much looking at the future. I forgot to go back and actually look at who the specific companies were that represented there that day. But some of them were companies whose products are found within bees. So consider a building product. I'm going to make this up. I'm not necessarily giving a company that was there that day. But let's say if you're looking at a carpet, for example, a producer would be the carpet manufacturer. And then the user might be someone who has determined that they're going to be building a new facility, and they're trying to determine which carpet should we use, or should we use carpet versus linoleum, or carpet versus wood floors, or whatever. So it would be a user of the tool at that point in time, not necessarily lead to differentiate that. But the producer would be the producer of the product that was actually within Nist and Bees. So whether it be a carpet producer or wallboard or paint or, you know, whatever it is.
Okay. I had another question here. You mentioned the use talks model. When might that go out for peer review? I believe it was for land use and water use impact assessment.
Actually, USETOX is for human health, cancer, non-cancer, and ecotoxicity. And that's the UNEP CTAC lifecycle initiative effort. So that's the consensus model that is coming out of that larger group. I am not the one who is involved with that particular effort. I have been trying to keep pretty close tabs on what's happening there. And the last I heard, they were hoping to have the medals in this fall. But they have been behind schedule before, so I wouldn't be surprised if they're still behind schedule on that. So it could be as early as this winter that we start doing the US EPA peer review on that. The land use and water use categories you mentioned, those are the ones I'm specifically working on and will continue working on, and perhaps with some assistance over the next year. Land use, expect to see a paper in publication probably in about 6 months. Water use, probably a year and 6 months from this point.
Okay. Are there other questions on the phone? Okay. I think we had some questions come in online. And Jean, did you want to go ahead and start reading those off?
Sure. Sure. The first one came in from Texas, and they ask, isn't there a point of diminishing returns of refining the LCA?
And I'll say yes. And that's why I think it's very useful. If you look at, and I had this discussion with Karen when we were doing Karen's particular project. Let me go to, if you still have your slides open, go to the big slide that shows all of the things that are involved with the ROMIC site. What slide that is. Okay. Slide number 35, I think it is for you. So if you look at slide number 35, it's probably going to be much easier to get what Karen calls level one on-site data, and then a little bit more difficult to get the transport data, and quite a bit more difficult to get what she calls level three, which is the manufacturer and then the raw materials leading up to manufacture. So the further you get from your site, the less well you know the data, which is common sense in a way. And that's why it's easier to rely on software that is already available out there. There are some LCA software programs that include inventory. There's also an EPA website called LCA Access, which points toward different inventory databases. So the better you can know your data on site, that's good, and then plug in some of these more generic databases to fill in your full life cycle assessment. Then when you're comparing your options, as Karen mentioned in the learnings there, the Region 9 learnings on the second from the last slide, point number three, lessons learned, it says, need to identify which materials and activities contribute the greatest to the impact category and research them thoroughly. So when you see what may appear to be a surprise to you, or what looks like it's an obvious big key player for each of these impact categories, You might want to look into that further, whether it be a mistake on the part of someone putting in the actual number into the program, or whether it truly is that large. You'll probably want to get that particular number to a better extent. So it's that iterative process. You start with an LCA. It's probably somewhat screening level. The more time you spend with refining those numbers, the better the LCA gets. But again, you would want to focus your attention on those impacts that look like they're most significant.
Great. There was another question that came in from Virginia. And this is just sort of asking how accurate you felt that the footprints or estimates were, and they want to know which areas or parts of your estimate or footprints did you feel that were the most difficult to quantify?
At this point in time, it all depends on the data. And I say at this point in time, but it will always depend on the data. So how well do you know the inventory? I just mentioned there's going to be some places where you know the inventory better than others. So for uncertainty, I can't give you a number. I can't say, you know, this is the amount of uncertainty that's going to be involved in it. I think each and every case study, how well you know your site, your transport, and your off-site emissions and resource uses really determines how well you know it. Now, for the individual impact categories, how comfortable do I feel with the uncertainty related to the impact categories? I would say that those impact categories that have international consensus, like ozone depletion and global warming, have had a lot more research going into them than some of the other impact categories. I'd also point out that I had a part of this slide which I cut out for the sake of time, but for several of these impact categories, acidification, eutrophication, and smog formation, you very well could have a site-specific feature there. The same with land use and water use. For land use and water use, it's going to be absolutely imperative that you know where the land was modified and where the water came from, because you need to know about water scarcity at that location. You need to know perhaps about ecosystems at that location. So for those two categories, you're going to have to do a site-specific analysis. For acidification, eutrophication, and smog formation, if you did a site-specific analysis and you kept track of, if you're thinking the whole life cycle assessment, not only the emissions that are happening on site, but your emissions that are transport to the site, and your emissions that go all the way back to the manufacture of the PVC pipe, and all the way back further than that. If you kept track of every single one of those site-specific locations and did your LCA with it, Tracy has the capability to do a site-specific LCA. That said, a lot of people do not do it. 99.99% of the users of Tracy just want to do U.S. average characterization, because an LCA is so difficult to do. So I mentioned I took out a whole portion of my slide that talked about how we have available all this great site-specific impact assessment methodologies within Tracy. The reason I took it out is because most people are not using it currently. There are still a lot of people who are doing research in that area and also in the area of uncertainty analysis. But at this point in time, there are very few practitioners who actually including that within their results, just because of the difficulty of maintaining all the uncertainty bars on every single data point, and then propagating it through the analysis.
Okay, thanks. Penny, that's the end of the online questions that I've seen so far.
Hi, Penny. This is Kirby Biggs.
Kirby?
Technology Innovation Office. Yeah. I've been interested in the Carnegie Mellon process, and they have their EIO LCA model, and there was a comment that they made in here. I noticed that Karen used three tiers, and that's the same kind of tiers that Carnegie Mellon suggests. And they say that if you stop at tier two, which would be the back to the electricity level, that you could overlook as much as 75% of the total greenhouse gases. That is, versus going back to the cow, let's say. You stop at the edge of the manufacturing facility or the edge of the site and just look at that footprint, which some people seem to have a desire to do. I just wanted to know what you think of that comment in terms of missing such a significant component if you don't go back to the primary resource.
Okay, I'm not sure if you meant this comment for Karen or for me.
Either one, but I think, you know, possibly for Karen, it's the Romic model, and we're working with that here at headquarters too, which I think she's done a fantastic job, by the way.
So this is Karen Sherman, and yeah, I can comment on that. I agree. It's really important to look at the manufacturing, and in fact, one of the last slides that Jane had, the pie chart, I don't know what slide number it is, that was illustrating that that concept and was illustrating the importance of going back all the way into the manufacturing. If you look at that, it's slide 41, if you look at that, the green portion of the slide, which is more than 50% of the CO2 footprint, is due to off-site manufacturing and actually also off-site waste processing.
Yeah, there it is.
That was one of the main things was of interest in our analysis, is that the manufacturing is very important to take into account. At least it was for this particular site and this particular alternative, and you know, I guess that could vary substantially from site to site and remedy to remedy, but that's what we found on this site and this alternative.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I mean, it seems to comport nicely with what Carnegie Mellon's been saying.
This is Jane. I'm looking now at slide number 35. Even though Karen called level 3 manufacturer, I think I mentioned within my presentation, she also goes all the way back to the cow or back to the well or whatever it is, all the way back to the raw materials extraction. So it may not be obvious when you look at the slide, but when you look at what she included within her analysis, she tried to be pretty comprehensive there.
Okay. Thanks.
Hey, were there other questions on the phone? Okay, and I don't think we had any other questions coming in on the website, so we'll go ahead and wrap up. Jane, were there any final things you'd like to add before we sign off?
No, thanks for setting this all up.
Great,
I would
thank
add,
you.
Oh, I just had one question. I'm sorry, this is Mikos Faberson, and I joined late. What's next? Like, where do you intend to go now?
Is this for Karen, or is this for me?
Well, I think... either or both of you can respond, probably for you, Jane, or Jean.
For me, I'm pretty consumed with not only the UNEP CTEC efforts, but also the land use and water use impact assessment. I think I mentioned earlier, and I'm not sure if you were on at this point in the presentation, but land use and water use are the most difficult categories to get a hold of. It's just because there are no regulations, and what is it that we're valuing? If we're looking at ecosystem services, for example, what is included and how do we do that assessment? Can we do it on a global level and can we do it site specifically? How can we include all those input parameters and make it practical for the users? So land use and water use are going to be very significant research projects for quite some time to come, I think. Karen, if you would like to mention what you're doing in the future, you could do that.
Yes, what we're doing in Region 9, at least, is we hope to run a pilot study. We consider this environmental footprint study a pilot study. We intend to run this kind of analysis on two additional sites. In fact, we've started those two sites, and we may end up doing a fourth. And we will use the experience and the learning curve from those analyses and those hopefully four sites to feed into EPA's methodology for doing this kind of analysis. So that's really the big picture for us is to develop that methodology. And again, EPA headquarters is leading that effort, the methodology effort. And then the ultimate hope is that then facilities and state and federal agencies would be able to use that methodology to run an analysis on their sites either during the decision-making phase, and then the results can be considered during decision-making for the remedy selection, or during any kind of optimization efforts for a remedy that may already be in place to help reduce the environmental footprint from an existing remedy. So that's kind of the big picture. We hope that the methodology will be ready in maybe, let's say, 6 to 8 months, and then, you know, we'll go from there. And I also know that it's not just Region 9 at EPA, but it's a number of other regions and also states who are beginning to run similar sorts of analyses to estimate the environmental footprints of their sites. They would almost be too numerous to name right now and here, but we're not the only ones in Region 9. We're not the only ones running this kind of analysis, but it's being done more and more throughout different parts of EPA.
Great. Thanks to you both. Sorry if you repeated an answer you gave earlier.
Okay. And other questions online, on the phone?
No more questions, but this is Kirby Biggs again in TIO. And I just wanted to mention that the pilots that Karen was mentioning are part of our overall green remediation strategy for hazardous waste sites, and that is now out for comment. You can actually get to that through the Superfund homepage of the EPA website, and we certainly are encouraging comments on that. And part of that strategy is to conduct pilots in every region, not only Region 9, but every region. So I just wanted to let you know that that was going on too. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any other comments or questions on the phone? Okay. Well, we're wrapping up a little bit early here, which is, I guess, always a good thing. So thank you again, Jane and Karen, and everybody else who participated and asked questions and listened in today. Again, you'll be able to find this presentation in about 1 to 2 weeks, the audio version as well as the presentation itself, the PowerPoint, online. And again, if you wouldn't mind checking out the feedback form at the end, then you can go ahead and just fill that out. We'd really appreciate your feedback on that. Okay. Thank you so much, everybody, and thanks again, Jane and Karen.
Thanks, Penny.
Thank you. Bye-bye.